implications we'll see in the second half. So there, essentially, if you want, we can see two extremes in this area. The first one is you might have problems where evaluating a function is very complicated. It might mean I have to simulate airflow around a plane. So solving a very complicated system of partial differential equations. So it takes a lot of time to evaluate these functions. In these cases, we might not even have first derivatives computationally available, and then people use techniques which are, for example, which are derivative-free optimization methods or surrogate model methods. And usually these have few variables. But this is not the case that I want to discuss today. I want to discuss the other extreme, where you have functions available. Usually they're actually given in an analytic form. One can compute derivatives, first, second derivatives, and we want to solve problems with a large number of variables, ideally up to several million variables. The short outline. And we'll first start with some background on nonlinear programming, what are the optimality conditions, maybe a little bit where they're coming from, and derive the basic primal dual framework for interpoint methods for nonlinear optimization. Then talk about, concentrate on one topic, that is, how can we guarantee that the method that we have actually is converging from the starting point that we give it? How can we ensure this? We look here at a particular kind of failure that can happen and how we resolve this. Then I hope there will be time. Talk about some recent research where we try to choose the barrier parameter. You will see later what that is. Most of you probably already know what that is. How we choose this adaptively in the algorithm using a quality function, and throughout the algorithm, throughout the talk, I would present numerical results. So I hope. So what are the optimality conditions? Just a very short crash course. Let's look at the. A very simple simple case where we have only equality constraints. So in this picture, say 3D case, the green line are all the points that are feasible. We might have an objective function where the negative of the gradient points this way, so I improve my point by going to this direction. So if I look at this feasible point here, I can see if I project the gradient, the negative of the gradient, onto the tangent space of my constraint, there's a non-zero component, and since everything is smooth, all the functions are smooth, I can improve my objective function staying feasible going into this direction. Of course, if I have the optimal point here, there's no projection into the tangent space that is non-zero. So we can write this simply by saying that we can express the gradient of the objective function as a linear combination of the constraint gradients. So, and of course, the point has to be feasible. These are now what we call the first order optimality conditions. If we make some more assumptions on the point of the optimal, the point that we consider, for example, that one constraint qualification, which is often used, is that the gradients of the constraints are linear independent, then we know that if we have a point where this holds, and which is an optimal local solution, we can find those multipliers lambda so that this holds. So numerical methods will try to find points that satisfy these conditions. Just to introduce some more notation, the Lagrangian function, probably everybody has, most of you have seen it, is defined in this way, which allows us to simply rewrite this first condition by saying all what we want is that the gradient of this function with respect to x is zero. Something I will not go much into will be, but I want to at least mention, is our sufficient second order conditions. If we have a point where the constraint qualification like this one holds, which satisfies the first order optimality conditions, and where the projection of the Hessian of the Lagrangian function is positive definite, then we know this is actually a strict local solution of the problem. So now let's look at the case where we have inequality constraints in addition. So again, we have here the feasible points that satisfy the equality constraints, and maybe we have an inequality constraint here where all the our points that satisfy this inequality constraint are up there. The first order optimality conditions are also known as the Peres-Kondracke conditions, are then written in this way. Again, we need, of course, for a point to be to be an optimal point that is feasible. Again, we can write the gradient of the objective function as some linear combination of the gradients of the constraints. There is a condition that says that the multiplier for the inequality constraint can only be non-zero if the constraint is actually active, because otherwise, of course, it doesn't matter whether the constraint is there in the problem or not. Okay, I mean, I have here some different cases, but I don't think I have to go through those. But one point that I want to make here is, if we now say we want to find a point that satisfies these first-order optimality conditions, in the first case, we had only a system, in the case where we have only equality constraints, we have a nonlinear system of equations, and we can try to solve this. In this case, it's getting more complicated because we have a combinatorial problem of finding which of these which of these inequality constraints actually are holding. Okay, just one quick thing here. So I described this just in the context of general nonlinear inequality constraints, but I will now, throughout the talk, assume that the inequalities that we have are actually bound constraints. So we have, I assume that we consider this case without loss of generality. We can reformulate general problems in this way. And then I can simply rewrite these optimality conditions in this way. And I'll have only Z here, the gradient of D is, of course, the identity matrix. My complementarity condition is expressed in this formula, where capital X is simply a diagonal matrix with the vector elements of X in the diagonal. Z is the same thing, and E is the vector of all one. So the products of Z and E have to be zero. So active set methods are one popular way to solve nonlinear optimization problems. Here we see the conditions again, and what those do is they basically guess which of the inequality constraints are active, then up to some accuracy solve the corresponding problem ignoring the inequality constraints, so solve a problem with only equality constraints, and we can do this by solving a nonlinear system of equations essentially, and then update the guess of activities and repeat the procedure. And as I assume everybody of you knows, in the LPs we have the simplex method for doing this. For NLPs, very popular class of methods are the sequential quadratic programming methods. They have a number of codes around for doing this. And there are other active set NLP codes like Lancelot and Minos. And, of course, the problem here is that if you look at large and larger problems, you have to fight with the combinatorial complexity of determining which of the inequality constraints are active, in particular if you have many degrees of freedom. On the other hand, these methods are rather nice if you have to solve a sequence of similar problems, because then your guess is usually already rather good. So this brings me now to assume that was, if in general, if I'm not clear, please interrupt, but I assume so far I was rather clear. So this brings me now to the concept of barrier methods, which are a different approach. We want to solve these problems. What these do, they take the complicated inequality constraints and add them into the objective function in terms of this barrier term. So if we choose a positive value of this barrier parameter mu, then this function here, the barrier function, will go to infinity if any of the components of X approaches its bound zero. So if we say we look at this problem for a positive value of the barrier parameter, since the objective function blows up in the, close to the boundary, the solution of this problem will lie inside, and one can show, of course, one can show that under certain conditions, the local solutions of this problem converge to a local solution of the original problem as mu goes to zero. And that's a framework that has been considered, I think, up in the 50s, and then there's a very well-known book that describes and analyzes these kinds of methods. So, of course, one way now to solve the original problem is then to say, I take some guess of my point, my solution, I take a value of my barrier parameter, and then I compute an approximate solution of this barrier problem, so with some procedure, to some tolerance, then I decrease the value of my barrier parameter in some way, and then I solve the increase this value, and then solve the next barrier problem starting from the approximate solution of the old one. And procedures like this have been implemented in software codes. For example, in Nitro, Loco, which is, does not quite fit in this setting, but I still wanted to mention the code and our code, for example. So now, this is the nonlinear optimizer way of looking at the barrier method. What you do is you solve a sequence of problems that have only equality constraints, these barrier problems. So how can we do this? We look at the first order optimality conditions for this problem, just the ones that we discussed, that I mentioned at the beginning. So what you try to find is x and lambda that satisfies the set of nonlinear equations. And we also know, of course, that our point x has to be positive because we have to take the log term. So if we want to solve this nonlinear system of equations, we can apply Newton's method. And if we do this, we compute Newton steps simply from this linear system of equations. Okay? So here, it turns out, if you just do it, that this W term here is the Hessian of Lagrangian function corresponding to this barrier problem. Now, the problem with this is, so this is now for fixed value of mu. The problem with this is, in the end, if you just look at what actually these quantities are, the gradient of our barrier function, you have the gradient of the objective function, and then you have here mu over x terms. So if you think about this, we're trying to solve a problem where in the end we want to drive mu to zero, but these conditions aren't even really defined in the limit, right? Similarly, if you look at what really this matrix here is, it is the Hessian of the Lagrangian function of the original problem, and then you have mu over x to the two terms. And some of those, as mu goes to zero, and our solution has variables that are active, these terms really become very large and go to infinity. So this linear system becomes really ill-conditioned. So originally when people started looking at barrier methods, this was the kind of viewpoint that they had, and then solving this linear system accurately was a problem. Also, the convergence as you decrease mu because of certain problems when you actually do the steps just made these methods not very practical. However, then there's another point of view, to look at into your point methods. And this is, I derived this here by starting looking again at the primal, the optimality conditions for the primal problem by introducing new variables defined in this way. So I replace this term now by my new variable z, which appear here. I keep this. And now I add another equation here that simply defines this term here. Okay? If I look at this system of equations now, this is nicer. As mu goes to zero, and I actually approach a solution where my x's are zero, there's nothing anymore that blows up. The system actually is defined in the limit. And if you're converging to a solution that has nice second order satisfies the usual the second order optimality conditions, the Jacobian of this system is actually non-singular, and the whole procedure looks much nicer. So okay, one point I want to make here also is, of course, this looks very much like the optimality conditions for the original problem. So another way to derive this primal dual system is here by saying that instead of actually requiring that I'm complementary in my primal variables and multipliers so that they are zero, I relax this condition and say they're equal to my barrier parameter mu that I, in the end, drive to zero. So and then people look at the concept of the central path where they say, well, this is the set of solutions parameterized by mu, and I try to solve, I try to obtain a solution to this nonlinear system of equations by looking at the central path and try to follow this path. Okay. So if I now want to solve, I want to find a point that satisfies these primal dual equations, I can again now apply Newton's method. which is now iterating in x, lambda, and the new dual variables, z. And again, now the Hessian of Lagrangian function for the original problem appears up here. So, this point of view. Next slide. Yeah. So this point of view is now basically concentrating on satisfying, solving a nonlinear system of equations. The first point of view, the primal point of view, was more like, okay, we solve a sequence of minimization problems, right? One important observation here is that I can look at this system here and solve for my variables delta z here, and then I see, so when I do this, this is simply what results. And if I compare this linear system with the one I just had for my primal method, the only difference is this term here. So instead of mu of, over x to the 2, oops, going the wrong way, I now have this term z over x appearing here. So the nice thing is that for this concept, where we can apply a homotopy approach and can show nice local convergence behavior as mu is driven to 0, we can use this and compute Newton steps corresponding to this, we can still interpret those steps as steps that correspond to solving a minimization problem with only equality constraints. So this one here. Right. Okay. So now, So now I'm at the point where I can say what the basic nonlinear programming interior point algorithm is. Given say, an initial value of the barrier parameter and some initial tolerance and some initial some starting point for my procedure, which has to be satisfy my my inequality constraints strictly, I then solve my barrier problem up to a given tolerance if it is, if I'm in the, at a point that actually does solve the current barrier problem to this tolerance, I reduce my my barrier parameter and tighten the tolerance. If that hasn't happened, or if it has happened in either case, I'll compute this primal dual search direction. Then, since the steps might go out, so maybe at this point I compute a search direction that goes into this, a Newton step that goes here, I compute the maximum step size that I can go so that I'm, say, not closer than 1% to the boundary than I had been at the current point. My, let's call it alpha tau. I do this for both my x and my z variables. Then I might choose some step sizes that might maybe are even shorter a little bit, but let's for now assume we actually take those maximum step sizes, update my variables, and continue. Okay? If I do this, one can show that this framework is locally convergent, meaning if I have a starting point that is sufficiently close and I update my barrier parameter tolerances and so on in a particular way, then I do converge to a solution, of course assuming that certain second order sufficiently conditioned, and I can show this convergence is superlinear. But in general, since we're also in a nonlinear setting, we need to make sure that we actually, given the starting point, actually do converge to a solution, because we don't, of course, have usually a starting point that is close to the solution. So for this, we have in our basic framework this line search, where we say, so I computed my maximum step sizes for my primal variables x and my dual variables z, and I want to obtain now the step sizes that I actually do want to take to update and obtain my new iterates. And there are different ways to do this. And what in our algorithm, what we do is we choose the maximum step size for the dual variables. And for the primal variables, what we do is we follow a backtracking line search procedure, meaning I have my maximum step size, I look at the corresponding trial point, and think about if, and have then to decide if I like this point. If I say I don't like this point, I cut it back, half it, say, and look at the next trial point and go on. And one procedure of, so the question now is, when do I like a trial point? When is it the point that I actually do want to accept as the next iterate? What people have done for solving problems that have, say, a objective function and nonlinear constraints is to use a so-called exact penalty function. This penalty function combines the goal of minimizing my objective function and trying to find a feasible point where the norm of the constraints goes to zero into one single function. And one can show, if one chooses this penalty parameter large enough, then a local minimizer of my problem with equality constraints is also a local minimizer of this problem. So what I do then is, in my line search procedure, I accept the trial point if it leads to a sufficient decrease in this penalty function. And this is something that people have done, and theory has been developed for solving problems with only equality constraints. But so that was also the first approach that we took. And then we found out something didn't really work well in some case. We have found a problem where things didn't work right and tried to distill really what is going wrong, and came up with this very simple example. And there's three variables, and there's only one nonlinear term, which is the square term in the first constraint. So if you look at this problem, functions are smooth, the Jacobian of the constraints has always full rank, there's only one stationary point, one point that satisfies the first-order optimality conditions, which has these values, which is the global solution of this problem. It satisfies the second-order optimality conditions, strict complementarity. It's as nice a solution and problem as you can wish. So, and then we tried our code with the starting point, -2, 3, 1, which satisfies, of course, these it's the interior with respect to the bound constraints, and it satisfies the first equality constraint. When we did this, these were the iterates that we obtained. You can see that the first variable starts at -2 and then becomes smaller and smaller and basically gets stuck, and the other variables basically crush into the bounds. So we keep generating directions that point outside of the bound constraints, and we have to then shorten the step size to make sure we're becoming not negative. Do this to the 1% rule. That's why we have always two orders of magnitude difference here. And basically, the algorithm fails. And if you try different starting points, it looks very much different. If I use a starting point that's maybe -3, the numbers here change a bit. So where the algorithm fails is always a different point, and it just depends on the starting point. And that's a scary. So there doesn't seem to be anything specific about this point where you converge to. So that's bad. So we then figured out why or what is happening, and one can actually show that you have to fail if you use the method as I outlined it so far. So here we basically see a two-dimensional projection of this problem in space x1 and x2. The blue parabola are all the points that satisfy the first constraint. And then if you look at the second linear equality constraint and the bound on x3, what that basically means is that all the point in order to be feasible, x1 has to be at least 1/2. Okay, so the feasible, and of course we have the bound on x2. So the feasible points are all those one here. If you say we want to minimize x1, that would be the optimal solution, right? So our starting point, however, in this picture is somewhere here, right? And in our step computation, we obtained the steps by taking Newton steps for the optimality conditions. And one thing, what that includes is that we say our step has to satisfy the linearization of the equality constraints. This means in this picture, if this is our point, the Newton step goes into this tangent on the parabola. Okay. So now let's say our algorithm picks this search direction. Then afterwards, once we have the direction, we say, oh, right, we have something else. We have this bound on x2. We have to make sure we're not getting negative for this variable. So that means if I chose this point, I cannot go further than here. So in other words, from here, I can only find a point that, again, is on this side of the parabola and up here. And that, of course, means I'm stuck. Okay? I cannot get out of this region here, and there's no way to get to a feasible point and to the solution. And the scary thing here is it would be if, for example, we would converge to a point that is a minimizer of the constraint violation. Right? So we have nonlinear problems. There might be our constraints might be such that at least locally the problem seems infeasible. If our algorithm would converge to such a point, that's okay. But this is not happening here. And so when we looked at this example, we also realized there were other algorithms for which actually global convergence proofs were given that failed on this one. What happened is that essentially the proofs made assumptions that implicitly assumed you're not getting close to the boundary. What else did I want to say? So, yeah, right, so the lesson to learn here maybe is, so the way we I presented how we maybe derive our entropy point method is to say, we have a problem that has inequality constraints, and we solve that problem by solving a sequence of problems that have only equality constraints. And then we said, okay, we know what that is. People have looked at this for a while, they know how to solve these kinds of problems, they use a merit function, they use Newton's method, and why don't we use this? And the reason why this doesn't work is because we have ignored the fact that we added something implicitly to the algorithm, which is that we have these bound constraints that the algorithm doesn't see when it computes the step. Anyway, so just to get back into this, into the algorithm, I was talking about this step of the algorithm where you have to compute the step sizes. And again, we're trying to be doing a backtracking length search procedure. And so this approach didn't work. We looked at, in order to fix this convergence problem, and also for other reasons, we looked into filter methods, which offer actually a remedy for that convergence problem. And I'm going to explain those now on a few slides. So the question is, so we had a point, we have trial points, and we have to decide, do we want to accept the trial point as the next iterate? So Fletcher and Leifer have proposed these filter methods, and what they said is, okay, we have this problem with an objective function and constraints, and we interpret this now as a bi-objective optimization problem. We want to find a point that minimizes the infeasibility, so theta is defined as the norm of the constraints, and I want to minimize the objective function. Okay, this plot here, I plotted this, the infeasibility measure, and here I plotted the objective function. So every point in the real space corresponds to a point here, say this is our current iterate, and the idea that, so all the feasible points are here, and the optimal solution would be somewhere here, say. What Fletcher and Leifer proposed is to say, okay, why don't I accept the point if it makes progress either in terms of reducing constraint violation or giving me a better value for the objective function? So say if this is my current point and this is corresponds to the trial point, I don't want to take this accept this as my next iterate because it makes both measures worse. Then how about this point? If maybe the next trial point is here, they said, okay, in principle we can take this, but we need the concept of making actually sufficient progress and not getting stuck. So for this, we could define a margin around this this kink here and say we only accept the point if it actually makes sufficient progress. So let's say this point here. So that would be acceptable. Or this point here would be acceptable as the next iterate. So one thing that comes to mind probably immediately is, well, okay, so what happens? I'm here, then I go to this point, I accept it. Then from here, I could take this point and accept it. So I could cycle. I have to do something against cycling. And for this, Fletcher and Leifer proposed to use a filter, which means basically they store these points, theta phi pairs corresponding to some of the previous iterates, and say if this is my current iterate, I only accept the trial point if I'm actually making progress with respect to this point, say this one here, but also sufficient progress with respect to my points in the filter. So I would not accept this point because it would bring me too close maybe to one of the current the previous iterates, but this point. Do I have time? It's 6 or 2? Started 15. Okay, so I will not go into too many details now here. One thing I do want to mention here is that one thing that can happen now is that we might be in a situation where this is our sequence of trial points, and actually I realize I can't find a point that is acceptable. Or, for example, I might be in a position where I'm at a point in my maximum step size that I can take is already so short that I cannot get out of this margin here. In this case, what the algorithm does is it says, I now switch to a completely different scheme. All I want to do now is I want to become more feasible, decrease the infeasibility, forget about the objective function and adjust to, by some other algorithm and find an iterate that finally is acceptable to my filter. For example, at this point, maybe I have my restoration phase algorithm, I have this as my first iterate. That's not yet acceptable, but this one might be. So this means that the algorithm sometimes breaks out of this scheme of applying Newton's method to the optimality conditions for the original problem, which then allows us to actually break out, also detect when we are running into trouble with this example problem, for example. Okay. So now, just to summarize the basic ingredients for the algorithm that we consider. We solve a sequence of barrier problems, and using a barrier method means that we can avoid the combinatorial complexity of identifying the active set. We want to use the primal dual formulation because that gives us good convergence as mu goes to zero. We approach the solution. We use Newton's method to compute the search directions, which gives us fast local convergence. And unless the function evaluations are very expensive in the algorithm itself, this is usually the most expensive part in the algorithm, and where it's important if you have structure and application to exploit it. That's something that Larry will mention. Then, once we have the step, we compute the fraction, we use the fraction to the boundary rule to make sure we're getting out a step that leads us out of the region. Then we perform a backtracking line search procedure using this filter approach. We have a global convergence result, so we can prove under pretty much standard conditions that we actually can guarantee that we converge. And a side effect of this is that if the algorithm seems to get stuck, it reverts to the feasibility restoration phase, which is a remedy for the convergence failure, but also allows us, in case we have an infeasible problem, to detect that quickly. So now, talking about software, this algorithm has been implemented. We call it IPOPT. It's in Fortran. The interfaces to AMPL and SIF, or if you have Fortran or C code, you can hook it up to that one. It's available on the NEO server at Argon. We're currently working on object-oriented re-implementation in C++, and you can get it for free at this web page. So now I have a comparison of our method on almost 1,000 problems from this CUTA standard. Well, it's a tester that people use to evaluate algorithms for learning programming, where the problems range from very small, two variables, up to 125,000 variables. The comparison, we did this a year ago when we worked on the paper. We compare that implementation then with the NITRO code by Richard Burt, Jorge Noseda, and Richard Waltz, and the local code from Bob Funder by Hannele Benson and David Chan of Benson. So we ran the codes with default options, and here's the comparison using performance profiles. I'm going to explain what that is. Everybody hates to explain these plots, so now it's... So this is so what I'm comparing here is the local code, the NITRO code. Then I have IPOPT no scaling and IPOPT scaling. No scaling is IPOPT has an option to automatically scale the problem functions so that if the problem seems to be really ill-conditioned, it makes it somewhat better for numerical reasons. The other codes didn't have that, so that's why I included the non-scaling version as well. What we see here in this plot is, so this axis reads not more than 2 to the x times worse than best solver, and here is percent of problems. What that means is that, for example, the red, so IPOPT no scaling was the best code, or was not more than 2 to the 0, so 1 times worse than the best solver, meaning in 37% of the cases it was the fastest in terms of iteration count. If you go a bit further, for example, here we know then that in 75% of the cases, the test cases, IPOPT, the new IPOPT was not took not more than 2 times as many iterations than the best solver. And then in the limit, because you penalize failures with iteration limit infinity, you talk about robustness. So in other words, the higher the curve up, the better. And this tells you something about robustness. So in this plot, it looks IPOPT is doing rather well. In terms of iteration count, we also have a plot for CPU time, and where excluded problems that were running for less than 0.5 seconds, and also there it looks rather well. So this sounds like an advertisement. Of course, I'm trying to advertise our method, but I'm not saying it is really the best method there is. there are the last 10%. These are problems where you run out of iterations, where the you run into problems where the linear system becomes so ill-conditioned that you can't do anything about it. You have sometimes so we have convergence proofs that we assume, so we make of course assumptions for to show global convergence. One of them is that you have at feasible points equality constraints are linearly independent. If that is violated, for example, you might come to a feasible point and get stuck there even though it's not optimal. So these are things that, you know, for example. Okay. But what I was trying to say is, I'm not saying this is the best code. In this comparison that I made, it looks rather good. But the point is, if you're looking for a code that you want to use for nonlinear optimization, you might want to think about using IPOM. Okay. I do have 10 minutes. Cool. Okay. So now I want to talk about some recent work which I did with Jorge Noceda, Richard Walls, and Richard Burt about adaptive barrier parameters. So I now want to talk again about this. So we have this point of view of an interpoint method for nonlinear optimization. We have the problem, and we convert it into a barrier problem and solve the sequence of those barrier problems. This is the Fiaco-McCormick point of view. And again, what you do is you fix your barrier parameter, solve the barrier problem up to some tolerance, and then decrease the barrier parameter and go on. There are many different variants of this scheme. There are primal dual methods. There are different handling of the constraints, line switch versus just region as a way to ensure global convergence. One nice thing is that you ensure global convergence of the overall algorithm by making sure that by solving just that each barrier problem can be solved. Right? If you know this, then you know that. So you know that at least you're making progress towards a point that then finally corresponds to the to the limit of the central path. But here are possible problems. If I choose my mu too large, this problem might be difficult, or it might be unbounded below. It might be that the barrier becomes so strong that it dominates every effect of the objective function. It is very difficult in practice to find a good starting value for this barrier parameter. It makes the algorithm scale dependent. And there's no reason why really fixing the barrier parameter is the most efficient way of handling it. We do not want to solve the barrier problem for a fixed value of mu, right? So then we have the other point of view where we look at simply the primal dual equations that we saw and say, well, okay, we concentrate on solving a nonlinear system of equations. And then you have to, basically we try to follow maybe the central path. There are many methods that adapt mu adaptively in every iteration, maybe even non-monotonically. And this has been proven very efficient, of course, as I guess everybody here knows, for LPs, QPs, and convex programming. But there are, in a sense, some issues. That is that if you look at convex problems, LPs or so, solving this nonlinear system of equations, so with zero here, gives you the global solution of the problem. However, if you have a nonlinear problem, you might as well converge to a maximizer or a saddle point. So it would be good if we actually, instead of really only concentrating on solving a nonlinear system of equations, still remember that we actually try to solve a minimization problem and look at the objective function value, not just its gradient. And yeah, that's what I just said. Okay. So what is the techniques that we know of choosing the barrier parameter in, say, linear program? So the question now is, how do we choose the barrier parameter? And one common way to do this is to say, well, I base this on the current value of the complementarity. So this is the average complementarity pair gap. And then I look at the centering parameter. And if I say I choose my centering parameter to be 1, all I'm trying to do is basically try to get my infeasibility and dual infeasibility down. But I try to keep the same level of my complementarity. On the other hand, if I choose sigma, my censoring parameter, to be zero, I'm trying to be very aggressive. I'm trying to compute a direction that directly goes there. And in nonlinear programming, a method that has been proposed is the rule that has been implemented in the Yoko algorithm. It's given by a formula that I didn't want to put down. But essentially what this formula does is, if I'm at a point where all my complementarity pairs are equal, so equal to the average, then it evaluates to a censoring parameter 0 here. So the algorithm computes a step that corresponds to this aggressive affine scaling step. On the other hand, if the iterates are not central in that sense, so that there's maybe one complementarity pair that's much smaller than the other ones, then it evaluates to 0.8 and then values in between. Another way to compute the centering parameter has been proposed by Mehrotra in his LP algorithm, where what he does is he at the current point where you are, you compute the affine scaling step, the very aggressive step, then you compute basically the maximum step before you leave the boundary, and you then look at what would be the complementarity at that point if I do this. And then he uses this magic formula to compute the centering parameter. If I can make large progress, my step sizes are large, the complementarity at the point I go to will be small, so this evaluates to a small point quantity, and if I'm not making good progress, then this is larger. So this, of course, requires an extra step computation. So we simply decided to see what happens if we try these rules in our algorithm. So we did this experiment in Nitro and in IPOptia, the IPOpt results, on the CUTA test set again. This time I only looked at problems that have at least one bound or inequality constraint. So it's about 600 problems. We see here again this performance plot. These runs were done without any globalization. So all I did was, at a point, I compute my value of the barrier parameter in one of these three options, compute the Newton step, and compute how far I can go with this step before I leave the boundary and then take 99% of that. And no further safeguard, no line search, nothing else. So we could see here that the monotone algorithm was behaving like this, the local rule was behaving like this, and Mehrotra probing rule performed best among these options. So now we thought, so what we want to do is we want to find a barrier parameter that is gives us a good step. So first simple observation is, if this is our primal dual step, so the step that we would take, and I already substituted this formula for mu here, then I can, of course, separate the two components, and I could compute and find the affine scaling step corresponding to this right-hand side and the centering step corresponding to this, and I can, of course, can construct the primal dual step that I would take as a linear combination of the two steps for all centering parameters that I might want to consider. So now we could say, given such a centering, our centering parameter, examining the probing points corresponding to this. So what do I mean by this? If this is our current point, and I choose some sigma, I might which maybe corresponds to this search direction here, I compute the maximum step size that doesn't bring me too close to the boundary, and I look at that point there. So what we now might want to do is, we might want to say we want to search for the best centering parameter that gives us the best step in some sense. The question is, what can we do there? So we could try to find one that minimizes some, we don't know a better word, quality function. For example, we could say what we really want to do is we want to find a centering parameter, so if we would take that step, it reduces our optimality error most. So this is if we would try to minimize this function here. But of course, this would mean we would have to, for every choice of sigma that we want to examine, we would have to compute gradients and functions, and that's rather expensive. So what we then said is, well, looks like the simpler case where we look at an LP, where every function is linear. And if you do this, it turns out that for the particular case of the LP, this is the function, this simplifies to this function. Of course, these the gradients here wouldn't change. And we said, why don't we try this now also for the nonlinear case? So this accurately predicts the primal dual error. If you look at QPs, it's very cheap to compute. Also an intuitive, well, one intuitive way to look, for example, at this term is if we have a large value, a large current value of infeasibility, we try to find a point that makes large progress in our variables. Okay, so this function over is non-smooth because you have these maximum step sizes with a rather complicated functions of sigma. It's non-convex, and we use the direct search procedure to approximately minimize this quality function. So we use Gordon bisection for this. So before I present results, just one quick remark. I guess I can just say that in a few words. This was about how to choose the barrier parameter. We still have to answer the question. So now that we are actually now changing our barrier parameter in every iteration, we still want to make sure that we actually converge given from any starting point. So how can we do this? So the procedure is very simple. We say, usually what we do is we compute mu by some oracle, by some rule, compute the corresponding primal dual step size, and then compute a new iterate. And at this point, we might actually do a line search and decide and look at the objective function constraint violation and decide if we actually make progress. Then we look at the new iterate and judge whether we actually make progress for the original problem. What we do is we simply monitor the KKT error. If we didn't make progress, for example, we didn't make the constraint violation worth in at most four iterations, then we continue with this. Otherwise, we simply fall back to something we know is working, which is the monotone mode. We simply execute now the Fiaco-Mikulnik framework. And if at that point, if we then get to a point that is close, make sufficient progress, for example, in the updatability error, then we go back to the free mode. So doing this now, here are finally some results, iteration counts. This is for netlib LPs. And one important point I have to make here is that we do not use any starting point heuristic. Usually, if you would develop an algorithm for LPs, you would, of course, try to find a starting point that is giving you, that already puts you in a good position to converge to the solution. In nonlinear programming, you don't really have that luxury of moving the point a lot because your functions are unpredictable. You don't really know how the functions will behave if you move your points too much. So that's why we said here, we just, whatever comes from, in this case, the SIF model, that's our starting point. Anyway, so what we see here is, this is the procedure if we use the global, the monotone Fiaco-Mikulnik framework. The red one here is the one if you use Mirocha's probing method, which was the one that was best in the previous one. This is done without the globalization approach that I said described on the previous slide. Then the blue curve is the one if you use this quality function without globalization, and then with globalization is this purple line. So what we see here is that it seems that using this quality function does make sense in this context, and also the globalization doesn't hurt. So it's not clear, of course, using this quality function approach requires more work than other LP algorithms would do, so it's not clear how that would look like in CPU time. So just finally, for the LPs, again, the ones that have only inequality or bound constraints, we see something similar. This is the default behavior that IPOPT has at the moment, the default algorithm, and here is the new one with globalization. So we see we can improve efficiency. I guess I have to come to the end. So I talked about optimality conditions for nonlinear optimization and how we can from those derive a basic framework for nonlinear optimization, and I discussed the issue of primal versus primal dual steps and talked about the monotone Fiaco-Mikulnik framework, and then I discussed the issue of globalization, showing that you actually converge from, how you can ensure that you converge from a given starting point. I talked about the difficulty you can encounter in this particular context of using an interior point NLP method, and described the line search filter procedure, and then talked about this, the active adaptive choice of the barrier parameter. Again, if somebody is interested in the code, this is a website where you can download this. Very important, I should say, of course, there's no collaborators. So Larry has Larry, of course, has been very involved in developing the IPOpt algorithm. Carl Laird is a current student of Larry's who has been working on the C++ implementation, which I have been using for getting the adaptive thyroid parameter results. And then, as I said, Richard Bird, Jorge Noceda, and Richard Waltz were involved in the adaptive thyroid parameter experiments. Okay, thank you very much.